Okay, and here is Lisa. Go ahead.
Thank you. Hi, everyone. So wonderful to see you all even virtually. Hopefully next year it'll be face-to-face. But what I will do is, first of all, I will share my screen. I'll actually take myself off the video first, and then I will share my screen. Okie doke. And then I'll put on my glasses so I can see what I'm doing. Okay. Now, I just want to, Annie, can you just help me? I just want to increase this so it's a full screen.
I think the toggle one. Try. No, this one here. Well, one of these. Click on the three dots. It will give you more options. Those three dots. Yeah, you're getting close, getting warmer. Yeah. Hide presenter view. Let's see how that one works.
Oh, yeah. Perfect. Thank you so much for that. Okay. So sorry about that, everyone.
Okay.
All right. So again, thanks so much, Hani, and thank you for giving me the opportunity of presenting today. For the next 30 minutes or so, I'd like to share with you a fascinating project that I have the honor of directing at the Red Sea Monastery of St. Paul the Hermit. Now, this project and those associated with it are very close to my heart. In a nutshell, in January 2018, I began a pioneering project at the monastery to digitize and catalogue their entire collection of over 1,200 unpublished manuscripts. To date, 5 field trips have taken place, with the last one being in January 2020. Working between 3 to 4 weeks each season, my team and I have clocked around 1,700 hours of work in the manuscript library, and we've completed the digitization and documentation of the physical attributes of 483 manuscripts out of 1,271 manuscripts. This work has been supported and facilitated by the generosity and hospitality of Bishop Daniel, the abbot of the monastery, as well as Father Sawiris of Ambabola, the spiritual father of the monastery, who first encouraged me and facilitated the initiative with great enthusiasm, but who sadly passed away 2 months ago with the coronavirus. And we will always be incredibly grateful for everything he's done for us. We're also very grateful to the monastery's librarian, Father Matthias of Ambabola, who has been a wonderfully helpful and accommodating team member. And finally, our thanks to the University of Divinity in Melbourne that has provided us with generous research grants in support of this project. But first of all, for anyone not familiar with where the monastery is located geographically, the Monastery of St. Paul is located about 400 kilometres southeast of Cairo, and it takes about 4 hours to get there by car. It's a beautiful scenic drive along the Red Sea coast, and the monastery is located inland from the Red Sea by about 20 kilometres. Now, in case anyone is not too familiar with Paul the Hermit or his monastery, as you are aware, Egypt has long been regarded as the birthplace of Christian monasticism. And Antony the Great is generally credited with being the father of the monastic movement. But as Jerome, Paul's biographer, emphatically points out in his Vita, it was Paul the Hermit who preceded Antony in withdrawing into the desert. And for that reason, he has been given the title of the first hermit. Now, according to Jerome, Paul took refuge in the Egyptian desert in the year 250 during the persecution of the Emperor Decius. But once the persecution was over, instead of returning home, he decided to advance further into the desert until he eventually arrived at the site where the monastery bearing his name is today. For about 90 years, we are told he lived in complete isolation without seeing anyone and surviving on the fruit of palm trees and half a loaf of bread delivered miraculously by a raven daily, as well as a natural spring of water that to this day still provides water supplies for the monastic community. At the end of Paul's life, we read that he was discovered by Antony the Great, who was also living in isolation on the other side of the mountain from Paul at the Red Sea. And it was Antony who buried Paul, according to monastic tradition, in the cave in which he had lived most of his long life. Over time, Paul's hermitage became the core of a monastic settlement that, except for brief periods of devastation at the end of the 15th century and again in the 16th and 17th century, has been continuously occupied for over a millennium. The monastery of St. Paul is testimony to the sustained devotion to the saint through medieval and 18th century wall paintings, multiple phases of development and expansion, liturgical items, and a rich textual culture manifested in a wealth of manuscripts. Now, the first account we have of the site associated with Paul the Hermit dates to around the year 400 by Postumianus, a friend of Sulpicius Severus, as well as Jerome. He writes how he visited two monasteries of St. Antony, which are at the present day occupied by his disciples, and that place in which the most blessed Paul, the first of the Eremites, had his abode. And it must be no coincidence that Postumianus visited Paul's cave, for we are told that before he travelled to Egypt, he had in fact spent quite some time with Jerome. And so it would not be unlikely that he had heard about Paul from Jerome and so was intrigued to make the journey out to the site. In fact, accounts of Western pilgrims and travellers to the monastery become well attested, in particular from the 17th century onwards. And we read how one of the main reasons for Western travellers making the trek out to the monastery, as well as to the neighbouring monastery of St. Antony, was in fact to acquire manuscripts. But in order to appreciate the effort these travellers went to get to the monastery, it's important to keep in mind that because of its geographic isolation and location, the journey took anywhere between 4 to 10 days by camel caravan across a very barren desert from the Nile Valley. Now, Jerome calls the region between the Nile Valley and the Red Sea monasteries as the waste and terrible desert, and this is because of the lack of water, and we do have accounts of pilgrims making the journey out and dying en route from dehydration. But lack of water was not all the pilgrims were worried about. They were also worried about the threat of bandits and also of wild animals. In 1901, the British traveller Sir Montagu Fowler wrote, "Because of its geographic isolation and inaccessibility, St. Paul's has scarcely ever been visited by Europeans, so that it is impossible to say what treasures in the way of manuscripts and antiquities might be discovered within its precincts." Then, writing in the early 20th century, a German traveller describes the region around St. Paul as "a terrible wilderness of mountainous country constitutes the immediate environment at St. Paul's. It's a precipitous cliff into the abyss, a gate of hell, more horrible than the fantasy of Dante could express it." So, keeping these visual aspects in mind, you can imagine just how valuable acquiring and accessing manuscripts and antiquities must have been to these people. But just in regards to the extant manuscripts in the monastery, there are two things that we need to keep in mind. The first is that between the late 14th century and up until the late 16th century, the monastery of St. Paul's suffered devastation a number of times at the hands of Bedouin tribes who pillaged and destroyed things on site. And so we can imagine that anything contained in the monastery library was destroyed. So that's why in the current collection, only a small number of manuscripts predate the 17th century. And those that have miraculously survived have done so because, according to monastic tradition or oral tradition, they were hidden in floors in monastic cells or even hidden in the monastery walls themselves. But it's my hope that as we work through the information contained within the manuscripts, we may come across some marginal notes or other important detail that may give us clues as to where some of these books may have been hidden, or even information about what had happened during the devastation. The second point to keep in mind is that between the 17th and 19th centuries, all the patriarchs of the Coptic Church were chosen from the Red Sea monasteries in unbroken succession. And these patriarchs afforded great effort and spared no expense to repopulate not only the monastery with monks after its devastation, but also the library with books. And we have already in our work come across several manuscripts that have been commissioned and endowed to the monastery by patriarchs, in particular Patriarch Ioannis XVI, who carried out substantial restoration projects at the monastery at the turn of the 18th century. So as a result, the majority of the manuscripts that we have come across so far in our work date to this period in time. So moving on to the events of the early 20th century, in 1929, Professor Thomas Whitmore, on behalf of the Byzantine Institute of America, commissioned some monks at the monastery to catalogue the manuscripts at St. Paul's. Now, this work, unfortunately, was never published, but I was fortunate to have located the handwritten catalogue in the archives when I visited Dumbarton Oaks in Washington, D.C. a few years ago. And it's this catalogue that we are using as our base in the work that we are doing in the monastery's library today. Then in our third season, my team by chance found the unpublished and undated handwritten catalogue of the monastery's manuscript collection that was done by Marcus Semeca and Yasser Abdel Masih around the year 1930. But the details, as you can see here on the slide, are quite similar to Whitmore's catalogue. Now, between the years 2013 and 2016, the abbot of the monastery kindly granted me the privilege of accessing the manuscript library at St. Paul's during my doctoral studies. And it was actually really difficult because there was no proper cataloguing system. And so it was really time consuming trying to find things. There is a current handwritten catalog. You can see a snippet of it here on the slide that is still used in the monastery today. But many of the manuscripts on the shelves don't in fact match up to the numbers in the catalog. And to complicate things, each manuscript contains various numbers, which make it really difficult trying to figure out what's what. And of course, the handwritten catalog that was done by Whitmore almost a century earlier is obviously not a documentation of the complete collection that is currently in the library, but only a collection up until the year 1929. And then after that, the monastery acquired some 400 extra manuscripts that were located at their dependency in Bush in the Nile Valley, as well as from various donated manuscripts. So then what happened was that the monks combined the two collections into one and not only changed classifications for a number of the manuscripts and at times incorrectly, but even changed the catalogue numbers themselves. So it's my intention, after we have documented the internal contents of all the manuscripts, to devise a new numbering system in which each manuscript will be registered according to a number that correlates to a classification grouping as well as language. In addition, there may be a small number of manuscripts that will need to be reassigned as a result of our clarification of their contents. Now, the other thing I noticed during my work in the library is that because for centuries the manuscripts were housed in the fortress as well as in church annexes, they lacked the conditions necessary for their preservation. And so as a result, many of the manuscripts have become damaged by moisture and insects. And so the request to digitize and catalogue their precious collection was first and foremost for the purpose of eliminating any further threat of damage to these manuscripts and so preserve them for posterity. It's also one of the aims of this project to bring in specialists to restore some of the most damaged manuscripts that are in urgent need of love, such as this one on the right-hand side of the slide. Okay, so it's a known fact that in the Coptic Church, it is one of the oldest churches in Christendom, and much of their tradition and wisdom is contained in manuscripts across monasteries in Egypt that are completely inaccessible. And so my hope is that through digitizing this precious collection and producing a detailed catalogue, we will be able to communicate and present the works of our ancient traditions to the scholarly community. And my expectation is that this project will also shed light and important new information and opportunities for research, such as in the area of monastic scribal practices, as well as Coptic liturgical traditions. So now I'd like to tell you a little bit about the manuscripts themselves and what our method of working is. Now, essentially, the manuscripts in the monastery's collection are ordered and documented according to five classifications. The first is biblical, of which there are 151 manuscripts. Then there's theological, of which there's 168 manuscripts. Historical, 143 manuscripts. Liturgical, of course, being the bulk, which is 788 manuscripts. And then there's a miscellaneous section of 66 items, of which 21 are manuscripts. And the remainder are items such as letters and papal decrees and so on. So in total, there are 1,271 manuscripts in the collection, which I think makes it one of the largest collections in Egypt after the Monastery of St. Anthony. Now, of the 1,271 manuscripts, the large majority are obviously in Arabic, and a number of them are in Coptic or bilingual Coptic and Arabic, mostly being biblical and liturgical texts. And the manuscripts in the collection date between the 13th and early 20th centuries. Now, there are four important tasks that are carried out as part of this project, and they are digitizing the manuscripts, documenting the physical attributes of the manuscripts, tracing all the watermarks within the manuscripts, and finally, documenting the internal contents and scribal conventions. And this task will be undertaken by text and subject matter experts. Now, the final task is obviously something that can be done from the scanned copies. And therefore, during our field trip, our focus and our time and attention is purely on the first three tasks that require work done on the physical book itself. So fieldwork takes place twice a year, which is in January and September, since these are the semester breaks in Australia. And the team of students that I take with me usually average between 4 to 6 in number, and task stations are set up, and so work is carried out in parallel. Also, prior to fieldwork, new project members complete a 2-week training course on manuscript handling and codicological principles, so that basically, as soon as we arrive at the monastery, we're able to hit the ground running. So with research grants provided to us by the University of Divinity in Melbourne, we've purchased a number of high quality scanners that we use. And as mentioned earlier, we have to date finished scanning close to 500 manuscripts. And to give you an idea of size, the average manuscript contains around 200 pages. But there are also plenty of really thick ones, as you can imagine from the spines on this slide. And the largest ones we've scanned number around 600 pages. So it's a very time-consuming process, but the team work long and hard, and I really am incredibly proud of them. So in terms of what we document, before we started our project, it was important to establish a clear and consistent set of methods with regard to criteria for inclusion and for the recording of manuscript contents. And so firstly, the decision was taken to catalogue every manuscript in the collection, even those dated to the early 20th century. Secondly, I developed a standard template for the recording of data. And this template includes 8 main fields of entry, and these are a short title entry, which contains the manuscript catalogue number, its classification, and its language, a physical description of the manuscript, which contains details about the page and cover dimensions, the paper type, the watermarks, the overall condition of the manuscript. Then there's the description of the binding, which describes what type of binding it is, the cover type, decoration, paste downs, and end bands. And also the construction of the book, the number of quires, and the type of sewing stations. And of course, these 4 aspects are what my team and I focus our attention on during our field work, because as I mentioned, this is what we need the physical books for, and this is what we spend our time documenting. Then the other information that can be done from scans includes the analysis of the contents, such as table of contents, colophons, endowments in full, dates, names of scribes, patrons, restorers, any important marginal notes. Then the layout of text, such as the foliation, the dimensions of the writing area, numbers of lines. And then we document the writing, the type of script, rubrics, and any unique features. Of course, there's also a description of the types of illustrations that are in the books. And then finally, if there's any other important or necessary information that needs to be documented. Now, there is a lot of data and information being collected, and my intention is that in the case where a scholar is not able to get access to the physical manuscript or a digitized copy for any reason, for whatever reason, at least the information that will be made available in the catalogue will be of value to them. Okay, so when it comes to watermarking, this is perhaps one of the most difficult tasks, given the fact that quite often the watermarks are hidden beneath text, as we can see on the left-hand side of this slide. But I've been fortunate to have some excellent artists who work with me who have been producing some wonderful traced images. Now, watermarks are a wonderful dating criteria, and in the case where we have undated manuscripts, watermarks have been very valuable in helping us ascertain a likely date for the book. So one of the greatest things about working in the manuscript library is making discoveries. And each time we go, we discover new things. And apart from coming across some of the most exquisite Arabic and Coptic manuscripts, we've also discovered some Ethiopic treasures and manuscripts, and even some Syriac ones. Now, these are in fact fascinating finds because they confirm for us the traveller accounts that mention the presence of Ethiopians and Syrians living in the monastery. We've also come across some interesting letters and correspondence, and all of these findings will provide new information that will hopefully help us to construct as well as reconstruct the history of the monastery throughout the different eras. But we also have discovered some things that are not so fun, such as boxes and boxes of fragments that have been discarded during the negligent rebinding exercise that took place in the monastery a couple of decades ago. So I think I'll probably leave that exciting task of finding a home for each of the fragment until the end, or perhaps for an enthusiastic research person. Actually, one thing that resulted from the negligent rebinding exercise is that we found by chance a lot of the discarded original covers of manuscripts before their restoration, and we've now dusted and cleaned all the covers and put them away in a safe place, and some of these original covers contain beautiful buckles as well as interesting paste downs, and would certainly be of value to anyone interested in researching bookmaking or bookbinding. Now, as I mentioned, the team that I take work very hard, on average more than 10 hours a day. But one of the greatest aspects of this project is that it gives the members a unique opportunity to participate in the life of the monastery by attending early morning liturgies in the ancient churches and caves within the monastery. They also have the opportunity of enjoying desert walks or just some quiet time in retreat, as well as spend time with some of the solitary hermits in their isolated mountain caves. So each field trip is not only a chance for the team to touch history, but also a chance for reflection in the beautiful setting of the Red Sea wilderness that is the birthplace of Christian monasticism. I thank you all for your attention.
Thank you very much, Lisa. Any questions? I guess we have something. Any questions, you can write it in the box. Just to give you an idea about the size of this particular collection, what we know about St. Macarius Monastery is about, they have roughly 500 manuscripts. I don't know how many they have in the other monasteries in Wadi Natroon, but I don't think it's that much. But we'll find out when we see things coming from the Syrian monastery soon, I hope. Phoebe was asking if these will be available to the public.
I'm assuming Phoebe's talking about the scans of the manuscripts.
Yes.
Okay. This is it's a process, Phoebe, that we need to get through to make the scans available to the scholarly community. So that discussion with the monastery is currently in progress.
But we should not put too much hope on that at this time.
At this time, I wouldn't. I don't really know. All I can say is that, as I mentioned, my intention is to make the catalogue as detailed as possible, so that if there are any issues in accessing copies of the scans, then at least the catalogue will actually provide, as much detailed information as possible.
There is a question by Michael about the Syriac manuscripts. Is it reflective of Syriac monks that were living there? Is there a tradition of this? Or could they have been brought from St. Mary's Monastery of the Syrians?
It's a very good question. And in all honesty, I don't know, because we haven't done any analysis yet on any of these manuscripts. So as you can imagine, our time at the monastery is very limited. So we really just focus our time on doing the things that require us to do the scanning or the physical documentation. But the analysis of what types of texts are there is something that will be happening hopefully in the near future.
Buna Theodore is asking if that project can be done in other monasteries. I guess the Pope is trying to do that, but every monastery is like the states in here. They seem to have a mind of their own. Whatever the Pope would say, it just dissipate on the way there as far as manuscripts. As far as the Coptic Patriarchate, that we still don't know. What happened is Brigham Young University went in the 80s And they did some testing on microfilming, and then it got stopped. So after a while, they decided to digitize it and put it on archive.org without, of course, asking for permission. But it's only biblical manuscripts, not liturgical ones. The Syrian monastery, I'm not quite sure they are documenting that now, but I don't know about having it available to the public, but at least we'll know what's in there eventually. A team from Yale University is working on that, and Mark Swanson and Ramiz Mikhail are participating in that. Do you want to add anything to that, Lisa?
Not really. I think you've summarized it well. I mean, every monastery is really independent when it comes to, you know, their support of these types of projects. You know, we were just very, very fortunate at St. Paul that we had a group of people responsible that are very, very supportive. So I'm hoping that you know, that other monasteries, and I think that there has been definitely, you know, some interest from other monasteries that have found out what's happening, both at St. Paul's and also with Steve Davies' group at the Syrian monastery. So hopefully that will encourage other monasteries to do the same.
Dr. Saad was asking, when you publish, make sure to make it copyrighted but accessible.
Sure.
Nothing is copyrighted that is accessible these days. Daniel is asking, is there any published catalog of the monastery manuscripts?
No, there's nothing published. And in fact, what's really interesting about the catalogs at the monastery is that we have in the last two seasons found by chance at least 16 versions of the catalog that have been done in the last, you know, 50 years. So it seems that every time there was, you know, a group of monks that would take over responsibility for the manuscript library, they would put together their own catalog, they would devise their own numbering. So we have some manuscripts that have like five different catalog numbers. So it's very messy at the moment. There is one main cataloging system that the monks are using at the moment that they put together in the 1990s. But as I mentioned, it's not very accurate, and it is a bit confusing when, you know, when the numbers don't match up. But nothing's published at the moment.
Then the last one I see is also from Phoebe on the access. This is a discussion that needs to be had more broadly about Coptic manuscripts. All scans of the old patriarchate are in the Marimina Monastery and are very difficult for scholars to access. There's need to be a better process procedure. Otherwise, Lisa, your excellent work could frustratingly lead to little access. Well, as far as the old patriarchate in Marimina, when I talked to them the last time, which was like 3 years ago, they said they only did 80%. And then the manuscripts were taken away. At least that's what the librarian said. And he indicated the name of who took it away, but this is recorded, so we're not going to say anything about that. They always ask for a letter from the patriarch if you want certain manuscripts. I don't know how that process work. I think Daniel Gerges, who presented the first paper, is working on something like that. So we'll see how that test case work, if that will be possible. But at least some of the manuscripts that they have outside of Egypt are becoming accessible. Not everything, not all the Arabic stuff, which is really where we have more meat as far as research, hagiography and history and stuff like that. The Vatican did some, but still they charged an arm and a leg for the stuff that they didn't. The same with Manchester and the British Museum. British Museum probably the cheapest after Paris. Paris put just about everything Coptic and most of the Arabic that was in their catalog have been posted. And if you need any of that stuff, I have all the links to them. Just email me. I guess that is the last question.
I think if I
could add anything, go ahead.
Comment on Phoebe's on Phoebe's comment. It's a very valid comment, Phoebe, and I'm very much aware of that. In fact, even throughout my own research, it's been, and especially as a female, it's been very, very difficult trying to get access to, to manuscripts or even just access to you know, monastic libraries generally. So I think that what's happened at St. Paul's has really been nothing short of miraculous. And I think that, we're really fortunate to be working with a very accommodating abbot and a very accommodating librarian as well, that I think sees the benefit in having their work or their collection accessible to the scholarly community. It's just, it is a process. And I think that, it's just a matter of us working with the monastery to put together an effective, process that will be of benefit. So I'm hoping that hopefully we will be able to have a collection that will be available for those who need it without too much pain.
Any other questions for the other people in the panel? I know you're all tired. And Phoebe is like your optimism.
Yes, I can read that.
Well, we can always pray.
We'll get there.
Just certain things need to be aligned. And that doesn't happen too often. But it will. I think the monastery need to feel secure that these things are not going to be used in research against them. And that's a major concern. And especially Western scholars, when they do things or they publish things, they are very critical. And I guess language, by the time it gets there and you have other people trying to, translate it for them, it usually come across very negative, and that doesn't help anyone. So it needs people from both sides to get closer so we can get that trust issue taken care of. Okay, if there's no other question, thank you very much, and we'll see you tomorrow at 10 o'clock. There is a different link that should be in your email. So don't try to come to the Friday one, come to the Saturday one, and we'll start promptly at 10, but we can allow people by 9:30. Okay? Thank you very much, and good night or good morning to everyone. Thanks.
Bye.
Bye.